Good morning, this is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. Federal Independent MP Andrew Wilkie has joined the growing rank of politicians who have turned down the Prime Minister's offer to join a cross-party group to receive information about the Christmas Island tragedy. Mr. Wilkie says it's unnecessary and thinks all briefings should be publicly released. The former intelligence analyst has told AM he wants action on two fronts, ramping up disruption operations against people smugglers in Indonesia and a more generous response to asylum seekers. To that end, he's revealed the opposition leader, Tony Abbott, offered to double Australia's humanitarian refugee intake if the independent MP would help him form a government after this year's election. Mr. Wilkie spoke to our reporter in Canberra, Alexandra Kirk.
It's ludicrous for the government to say, you know, it's spending all this money and it's doing enough, because whatever it is doing is clearly not working. And when I think back to when I was involved in the intelligence and security services back in 2002 in particular, there were things being done there which were helping to stop the boats. Now, I'm not talking about Nauru and so on, which was patently contrary to our treaty obligations, patently unethical, but there were other things that were being done which should be done now. And the government may well be involved in disruption operations currently, but whatever they're doing is not working. It has to be ramped up. We have to hunt the smugglers down and put them out of business.
Do you think the government's dropped the ball?
I think the government has dropped the ball.
So what does disruption mean? Destroy people smuggling boats before they leave port?
Well, ultimately, that's the aim. You know, we have a highly competent defence force. They have very good equipment. But even the best defence force with the best equipment, the highest level of competency you can imagine, is still going to struggle to pick up small wooden boats in that big ocean. You've got to stop the boats leaving Indonesia. So you've got to disrupt the business of the smugglers. I'm not going to go into the detail of how you might do that. You could imagine any number of ways where you can disrupt their business, prevent the boats leaving port in ways that don't put any lives at risk. Because once those boats are at sea, then the lives are well and truly at risk.
You want a more humane response to asylum seekers. The opposition says those calling for more compassion should think again, that softer policies will only compound the government's weakness, that's the federal government's weakness, and encourage even more boats. Do they have a point?
Not a point in the way they're making it. You know, they are playing to some of the darkest sentiments in the Australian community. You know, I'm interested to hear these comments from the opposition at the moment, because during my negotiations with Tony Abbott, immediately after the federal election 4 months ago, one of the issues he raised with me in an attempt to get my support was to double the humanitarian intake into this country from about 13,500 a year to double that, what, about 27,000. So, you know, he certainly sees situations in which we would have a much more compassionate policy. This is a time to resurrect that offer of his and to say, well, why can't we take a little bit of pressure out of this pressure cooker and bring more people in through an orderly queue?
Do you think that would discourage asylum seekers or those who've been granted refugee status from getting on a boat to come to Australia?
Well, I think it is the case that if we have a substantially larger humanitarian intake, it would encourage more people to come through the regular immigration route rather than the irregular immigration route.
Do you plan to formally ask the Gillard government to double the humanitarian intake?
Well, I'm raising it with them now through the media today. It'll be abundantly clear to them this is something that I see as a priority. You know, this isn't a case of setting up another committee and talking about it for another 6 months. This is a case of looking at what we can do now and implementing them now. If we wait another 6 months, more people are going to die.
Federal Independent MP Andrew Wilkie speaking to Alexandra Kirk. A spokesman for the federal opposition leader, Tony Abbott, has denied that Mr. Abbott canvassed doubling the humanitarian immigration intake during talks with Mr. Wilkie. The spokesman says, consistent with the election policy, a modest increase through the established United Nations channels was discussed. Behind the security wire at one of Christmas Island's detention centres, survivors of last week's boat disaster have held a memorial service for those who died. The island has been in a state of shock since at least 30 people were killed when a people smuggling boat was driven by high winds and seas against cliffs at Rocky Point, directly in front of the Christmas Island township. As Andrew O'Connor reports, for many of those who tried to save the men, women and children on the boat, the horrific experience is only now hitting home.
There's a strange, almost haunting silence at Rocky Point, just a few metres up the road from the Christmas Island police station. It's a rugged but unremarkable stretch of coastline where the water heaves and crashes against the sheer cliff face that rings the island. There's almost nothing to hint at the horror that unfolded here in front of locals on that fateful Wednesday morning. When lifelong Christmas Islander Kamar Ismail stands here, he can still hear the echoes of cries, of screams, and of the desperate pleas for help. And he still sees the faces of those he tried to help save, but could only watch die.
While we're down on the cliff, we could see people on the boat near the cliff there shouting, "Help, help, help." And I saw a woman there, a few men and a few kids in the boat. And one man actually picked up a baby, said, "Baby dying, baby dying." No, and the waves start pushing the boat closer and closer to the cliff.
Wave after giant wave then smashed the boat against the cliff.
I kept on trying to look for the baby that the man was holding, but I couldn't find.
Like others, he threw in life jackets to some of the asylum seekers and tried to pull others out with ropes, only to have the ropes snap on the jagged rocks. The few metres that separated the rescuers from those in the water proved an unbridgeable divide.
It is only a two metre away from them, or 3 metre when the waves start picking up, when the wave was level up with the rock. You can see the people, but you just, if you jump, you're killing yourself. You only can look at them.
Kamar Ismail also wonders about the anguish of the 42 shipwrecked survivors, saved from the mountainous seas and now locked in detention. And he wonders about the other asylum seekers who may have had family on the sunken boat.
Was one of the people that got killed in the water, is it one of their kids or is it one of their wives? Because they might be travelling different boats.
Trauma counsellors are being sent to Christmas Island to help rescuers like Kamar Ismail come to terms with what they saw and heard that day. He says he's not yet having trouble sleeping, but already senses that this experience will be with him for the rest of his days.
It still lingers in my mind with that man holding that baby, you know. That baby was alive and he was saying that, baby dying, and a woman pointing to me to the back of the boat said, there's baby, you know. I still remember that.
Andrew O'Connor on Christmas Island, reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM around Australia on ABC Radio National, where it's approaching 18 minutes past 7. Internationally, we are on Radio Australia. Fears of war on the Korean Peninsula are building, with the South vowing to push ahead with a live-fire military exercise, despite the grave threats of retaliation from the communist North. The drills on a South Korean island, shelled last month by North Korea, could begin as early as today, depending on the weather. So worried are world powers about the potential for confrontation, the United Nations has convened a meeting of its Security Council. North Asia correspondent Mark Willis reports.
For Yoon Jin-yong, the tension is too much. The 48-year-old is packing up and getting off Yeongpyeong Island. After last month's bombardment by North Korea and the threat of more artillery strikes, he's too scared to stay. The residents here are getting more nervous because our military is planning to hold a shelling exercise, says Yoon. Now the North is threatening to strike back, so I'm worried. I'm now heading to get the ferry to the mainland, but it hasn't arrived yet. So we're all anxiously waiting for it, he says. When North Korea shelled Yeongpyeong Island last month, the barrage killed 4 people, damaged dozens of homes, and left the peninsula teetering on the brink of war. Pyongyang says it opened fire in response to a South Korean live fire exercise on the Yellow Sea Island. Now the South wants to conduct another military drill on Yeongpyeong, drawing more fire and brimstone warnings from north of the border. If the South conducts this shelling, despite our warnings, we will strike a second and third blow against them, says this newsreader on state TV in Pyongyang. These strikes will be greater in strength and scope than those we launched last month, he says. But many in the South are sick and tired of bowing before Pyongyang's threats. Screaming for revenge against North Korea, these protesters on Yongpyong Island released balloons containing anti-Pyongyang messages. We're here to let the North Korean people know the truth about the regime's brutality, says protest leader and North Korean defector Park Sung-hak. We'll tell them of the shelling attack on this island through these leaflets, he says. But with a population starved of information, food and political freedom, that's unlikely to make much difference over the border in North Korea or to stop the shells from falling on the south. This is Mark Willacy reporting for AM.
The US president will this week sign into law the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which for 17 years forced gay servicemen and women to hide their sexual orientation. The weekend vote received support from a handful of Republicans, giving Democrats the numbers they needed. It's being viewed by some as a significant step towards equality that will have ramifications in other parts of American society, including gay marriage. Questions remain, though, over just how and when the new policy will actually be implemented. North America correspondent Lisa Miller has more.
The repeal had appeared doomed at one stage, but with eight Republicans joining the majority of Democrats and two independents, the 17-year ban on homosexuals in the military was cast into history. But not before more than 13,000 troops were discharged because of it, like former Army officer Dan Choi.
It's a historic day, as everybody's been saying, but it's something that we've all expected. You know, we know that when you're on the right side of justice and history, you don't ever go backwards.
Senator John Kerry, who served in Vietnam, welcomed the historic move.
Gay people have served the United States with distinction. They've won awards. They've given their lives all through our history. We had a policy that asked them to lie about it. They no longer have to do that. I believe it fulfills an enormous promise of equality in our country. It's an historic day.
Democrat Dick Durbin says it has more support than the move to end racial bias, which took place over 5 years during the Korean War.
They surveyed and found that 70% of those military and families asked said they were prepared to accept this. The number, incidentally, when those in the military were asked about integration some 60 years ago, was 20%.
Those opposed to the repeal, like Republican John Kyle, argue it will hurt troop morale and frontline fighting capabilities.
I frankly have to follow the lead of people like the Commandant of the Marine Corps, like my colleague John McCain, who say that when it comes especially to the small units who do the fighting on the ground, the U.S. Marine Corps, the Army combat troops, who, according to the survey taken by the Pentagon, were 60% opposed to this, it could disrupt unit cohesion and, as the Commandant said, cost lives. That means a lot.
Top U.S. military commander General Ray Odiono says it'll be brought in gradually.
The most important thing is how we implement the policy, and we want to make sure that we're given the appropriate time in order for us to implement it in such a way where it can be successful.
But that's raised concerns among lobbyists who fought hard for the repeal. While describing the vote as courageous, they argued there's no need for a lengthy period of training or education to prepare troops. They say the Pentagon has the capacity to train forces immediately within a matter of weeks, ensuring a smooth and quick transition to a military that welcomes gays. This is Lisa Miller in Washington for AM.
Some of the worst flooding in living memory has hit the West Australian town of Carnarvon, 900 kilometres north of Perth. The town is cut off on all sides by the flood waters. The Gascoyne River is expected to peak sometime this morning. A short time ago in town, it reached 7.8 metres at Nine Mile Bridge. While there's been no loss of life or serious injury, authorities say more evacuations are likely. Already 200 people are sheltering at a local centre. I spoke earlier with Ian Comben, an area manager with WA Fire Services, and asked him whether he'd seen flooding like this before.
Certainly equal the flooding that occurred in Carnarvon in the year 2000. That was a pretty extreme event. Certainly the floodwaters at the moment are equal or above the levels that were reached then.
Now, the town, as I understand it, is completely cut off on all sides. How are the people coping and where are they going if they've had to evacuate their homes?
Well, at the moment, the civic centre in the run by the Shire of Carnarvon is an evacuation point, with backup at the high school. So people have been relocated to the Civic Centre, or the Woolshed as it's known, in downtown Carnarvon.
Now, Carnarvon, the town, was inundated with water from heavy rain. Then the the catchment area was inundated. Have you seen the worst of the flooding, do you think?
We hope it won't get any worse, but at the moment it certainly appears to be peaking.
The caravan park is already underwater. What about evacuations around the town? Do you think you're going to have to do more?
Well, at this stage, an evacuation of the Capricorn caravan park is imminent, and we believe now there is some water starting to enter some streets. So we have SES crews out now assessing that with a view of sandbagging, or we may even have to evacuate a couple of streets, people from houses in a couple of streets.
How are the people coping in town with all of this? Because, as I mentioned, you are completely cut off.
Yeah, well, it's not probably that unusual an event in Carnarvon, a flood of some sort. When the river does come down, the Gascoyne River, it often does flood the low-lying areas of the town, but certainly not usually to this magnitude.
The people are taking it in their stride.
Well, at the moment, there's probably not a lot they can do about it, given that the only way out is by air.
And as far as food and sort of fresh water goes, people are getting by there. There's plenty of stock in town, I assume.
Well, with the SES crews up in Carnarvon now have done an assessment of food stocks in the big stores and that, and I believe there'll be arrangements made today to fly supplies into Carnarvon, and certainly that will include water.
Ian Comben from WA Fire Services. In the 1890s, when Banjo Paterson wrote, "On the outer Baku, where the churches are few and men of religion are scanty, on a road never crossed except by folk that are lost, one Michael McGee had a shanty," his poem Bush Christening touched briefly on a subject that still resonates even today, the lack of priests in the bush. Numbers are getting so low, the Catholic Church is looking abroad to fix its priest predicament. A Queensland bishop believes the vow of celibacy is largely to blame. From Longreach in outback Queensland, Kieran McKechnie reports.
When New Zealand priest Father Doug Hoare heard about a chronic priest shortage in Australia, he decided to answer the call to pitch in.
They told me that Longreach was about 600 or 700 kilometres inland, bordering the desert, and I thought, that's the place where I should go.
His new home of Longreach in Queensland's central west is a long way from his parish in chilly Dunedin.
I went from snow to, I think, 36 degrees. They ask me in New Zealand, how do you cope with the heat, and especially if it gets to be about 45, and I always tell them I hide. I go missing.
His parishioners are happy to put up with his temporary disappearances. They'd been doing without a priest since theirs retired in the middle of the year. The shortfall, though, is not confined to the outback. The Catholic Church is struggling to fill positions across regional Australia. Now it's looking to other countries to provide relief.
In many ways, it's like the turning of the cycle. Because in the early days of the church, a lot of priests came from Ireland. And then as Australia developed, Australian priests went as missionaries to Papua New Guinea in South America. So the cycle has gone round again now. We don't have the number that we need, but other overseas countries are able to sort of help us.
Brian Heenan is the Bishop of Rockhampton in central Queensland, which is about to recruit 3 priests from India. He says the trio will receive intensive training before they're unleashed on their parishioners.
The difference in culture, as we would realise, is very considerable. So that's been the experience all over Australia, that when these good priests arrive, that we sort of won't put them straight into parish life. We'll gather them perhaps with experienced parish priests who can sort of help them to understand the different culture that they're coming into.
Brian Heenan says it's the cultural change in Australia that's deterring young men from entering the priesthood, including more career opportunities with better pay. And he concedes the vow of celibacy is a big turn-off.
I'm sure it is, yes, I'm sure it is too, because there are lots of people who just see, you know, the life of marriage and relationship as part of their calling. And that is not as appealing to people as it used to be.
Rockhampton Bishop Brian Heenan ending that report by Kieran McKechnie. To the financial markets now, and the dollar is buying 98.8 US cents. That's steady on Friday's close. It's fetching 83 Japanese yen, but the big news is that it could be a bit of a record. It's now fetching 75 euro cents. Spot gold is up by about $5 to $1,375 an ounce. Tapas crude in Singapore up by about $1.50. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for this morning. It's 7:30 and a very good morning to Julian.
Good morning, Tony. Now, I've certainly got egg on my face this morning.
Oh, dear.
I'm trying to remember, though, whether you predicted on Friday that Australia would comfortably win the test in Perth.
Yeah, I think I did.
Didn't
I say that he was going to take quite a few wickets, young Johnson?
And, absolutely spot on.
Yeah, I don't know whether I tipped Ricky having the problem with his finger, but I'd have
you
to go
probably
back to the
did
books
as well,
and have
Tony,
a look at that.
Yeah, yeah. On the money, as always, Tony Eastley from AM.
Thank you very much,
Julian.
Very kind.